This is Audible.
Better Listen presents Thusness Part 1 with Alan Watts.
This is based on the Sanskrit word tat, which is etymologically the root of our word that. And it's supposed in India, you see, that this is the first word that a baby says. We all know babies say da, da, da. And in our highly paternalistic culture, it's assumed that the baby is addressing its father. And so dada means father. But in India, which is where the cultures anciently were matriarchal, it didn't even mean mother, but da, which was the fundamental word of all words. It is the baby pointing to it and saying that. Because when the baby wakes up and is, the, as I said last night, an aperture through which the all looks at everything, the great and proper exclamation is when it sees it is to say da. And so tathata is da-da-da. And it means just exactly that, in the same way as there was a Dada school of painting in the West, because they wanted to go beyond words and names, because a Dada would argue, when you call a dog doesn't sound anything like a dog sounds. Or chien in French sounds nothing like a dog. But if you called a dog, woof, woof, that would be a proper name for a dog. So this is a fundamental word. And we have great difficulty in translating it, because in a way it's a meaningless word. Now then, in order to understand this subject properly, I must not take too much for granted. I have to give you some introduction to Buddhism, because this is all part of Buddhist philosophy, and Buddhism finds its context in the philosophy of India. And we have to go, first of all, very thoroughly into what Buddhism is about. And the first thing I want you to understand about Buddhism, that very few people do understand, is that Buddhism does not have a doctrine in the same sense that Christianity has a doctrine. There could be no such thing as a Buddhist creed. The word dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, in Sanskrit, which describes what Buddhism is called the Buddha Dharma. Dharma means method, not doctrine, not law. It's often translated law. That won't do at all. Dharma sometimes means function. The function of somebody, his svadharma, means roughly what we would call his vocation. Dharma can also mean, in a peculiar way, a thing, a basic portion of the world, a thing or event. But its primary meaning, as used in the phrase Buddha Dharma, is method. And so Buddhism is a method for something or other. And so for this reason, all Buddhism is a dialectic, a discussion, an interchange between a preceptor or guru or teacher and his student, between the Buddha and his disciples. Now, what is it about? First of all, the word Buddha comes from a Sanskrit root bud, B-U-D-H. And bud means to be awake. So a Buddha is a person who is awake. It is therefore a title, it's not a proper name, and it's not the name of a divinity. There are many, many gods recognized, angels we might rather call them, in Buddhism, but they are regarded as being inferior to a Buddha. The gods are not yet fully awakened. Buddhism divides the world into six divisions. And this is very important for understanding what's it about. You don't have to take these six divisions literally, because they may equally well refer to states of human consciousness. But the six divisions are like this. You see, you draw the circle of the wheel of life. And in the top section of the circle, you have the Deva world. And Deva, from which we get our word devil, actually means the angels. The reason is this, that when the Iranians had battles with the Aryans, the northern Indians, the northern Indians called their gods Deva. So the Persians insulted them by using that word for devils. And then they had here Asura, who were in this division, and these are spirits of wrath. And so opposite, Ahura in Persian, Ahura Mazda is the Lord of Light, because they were enemies. But so here are the Devas on top. Next to them on this side are the powers of divine wrath in the sense of energy, vigor. And below, opposite the Devas, are the Naraka, and those are the purgatories. That's where everybody is as unhappy as they can possibly be. Here are animals in this section. Here are men and women. And here are things called pretas. Pretas are frustrated spirits with very large stomachs and very small mouths. Now, this is the rat race of existence, called samsara in Sanskrit. Samsara, the round of birth and death. And this is the nadir, this is the zenith, and this is the nadir. This is as high as you can get, that's as low as you can get. And that's always going to happen to you while you work on the principle of a squirrel cage. That is to say, so long as you are trying to make progress, you will go up. But up always implies down. So while you are trying to get better and better and better, that means that when you get to the best, you can only go on to the worst. And so you go round and round and round, ever chasing the illusion that there is something outside yourself, outside your here and now, to be attained that will make things better. And the thing is to recover from that illusion. So a Buddha means somebody who has woken up and discovered that running around this thing may be fun, and it may be good to run around, but if you think you're going to get something out of it, you're under illusion, because you are forever the donkey with the carrot suspended from his own halter. Now then, it goes on to say that there's only one place, one point in this wheel, from which you can become a Buddha, and that's here. The Devas are too happy to become Buddhas, or to worry about becoming a Buddha. The Narakas are too miserable. The Asuras are too angry. The animals are too dumb, and the Pretas too frustrated. Only in the middle position, the position of man, which is, you could say, the equal position, the position of sufficient equanimity to begin to think about getting off this rat race, only from there, you see, can you become a Buddha. So the position of a Buddha may be represented either as not on the wheel at all or as right in the middle of it. It makes no difference. And so he is just as in a way the axle point, the still point of the turning world, as to use T.S. Eliot's phrase, is the unmoved center, the unmoved mover, the primum mobile, the axle tree of the world. All sorts, the navel, that's why yogis are said to contemplate their navel. The navel isn't on their tummy, it's this place, the navel of the world. So that's the scheme of cosmology, of ancient Indian cosmology in which Buddhism arises. So you see, therefore, a Buddha is one who awakens from the illusion of samsara. That is, from the thought that there is something to get out of life, that tomorrow will bring it to you, that in the course of time it'll be all right. And therefore one is set pursuing time, as if you were trying to quench your thirst by drinking salt water. Now, I can exemplify this a little more strongly by relating Buddhism to the social system in which it arose. A Buddhist monk is sometimes called a shramana. S-R-A-M-A-N-A, shramana. This is closely allied to the word shaman. And a shaman is the holy man in a culture that is still hunting. It isn't settled, it isn't agrarian. There is a very strong and important difference between a shaman and a priest. A priest receives his ordination from his superiors. He receives something from a tradition which is handed down. A shaman doesn't. He receives his enlightenment by going off into the forest by himself, to be completely alone. A shaman is a man, in other words, who has undergone solitariness. He's gone away into the forest to find out who he really is, because it's very difficult to find that out while you're with other people. And the reason is that other people are busy all the time telling you who you are, in many, many ways, by the laws they impose on you, by the behavior ruts they set on you, by the things they tell you, by the fact that they always call you by your name, and by the fact that when you live among people, you have to be in a state of ceaseless chatter. But if you want to find out who you are before your father and mother conceived you, who you really are, you almost have to go off by yourself. And go into the forest and stop talking, even stop thinking words, and be absolutely alone, and listen to the great silences. And then, if you're lucky, you recover from the illusion that you're just little me, the so-and-so, and you attain the state of nirvana, which means the blown-out state, the relieved state, the sigh of relief. Nirvana may be translated into English as, "Phew, I've at last discovered that I don't have to survive. I can survive, of course, but I don't really have to." Because you discover, you see, that what you really are doesn't have to survive, because it's what there is. The real you is it, or that, tat tvam asi, that art thou, as the Hindus say. So then, in the normal life of India, which is not a hunting culture, but a settled culture, there are priests, but there is something beyond the priest. That is to say, when a man or woman has fulfilled his or her life in the world of society, it's the normal thing to do for a person to quit their status in society and become what's called a forest dweller. That is almost, you see, to go back to the hunting culture. They divide people into two classes, grihastha, which means householder, and vanaprastha, which means forest dweller. And the older people all hand over their occupations and positions to their children and enter the stage of vanaprastha, or become a shramana, and go outside the stockade I'm speaking metaphorically. They sometimes do, actually. They sometimes don't. And become a nobody. They give up their name. That is to say, the label which designates who they are in terms of caste or class. They become unclassified people. That's why, strictly speaking, you see, Hinduism and Buddhism are not religions. You can classify the religions. You can say, what's your denomination? Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Quaker, etc., 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 you see. But strictly speaking, a vanaprastha, a shramana, has no label. He is an unlabeled bottle. So, in the time when the Buddha lived, about 600 BC, the Hindu system had become somewhat decadent. It isn't altogether clear what had happened to it, but it is certain that it did seem in some way to be in need of reform. And so there were many reasons for this. And the Buddha, as a young man, being basically troubled by the great problems that we're all troubled with, the problem of suffering, and the problem of what all this universe is about, he endeavored to follow the methods that were then being used by people who were shramanas or vanaprasthas, forest dwellers. And at that time, it's very apparent that the main method that these people were using was an ascetic discipline. Starvation, very arduous meditation practices, probably self-flagellation and things of that kind. And it's said that for 7 years he practiced these austerities. But he found out that they didn't lead to liberation. And all the people who were practicing them knew they didn't either. But they felt that that was only because they weren't doing it hard enough. And so he propounded instead the middle way. The way that led to liberation from the rat race that I've drawn here, neither through austerities nor through pleasure seeking. See, these are the two ways, the two paths. The people who say the whole point of life is to enjoy it, to get the most out of it, you see. And the other people who tried that, and then they found it was sour grapes or something, you know, or they burned their fingers in the pursuit of pleasure. The girl that was so beautiful eventually fell apart or just turned into a shrew and whatever it was. And so they said, instead, let us torment ourselves. A lot of people enjoy this or get something special out of it. I was in Mexico this summer, and what I went there for was to study Mexican Catholicism, where they make a great cult of suffering. And I was very puzzled about this and wanted to understand it. And everywhere, you know, they have these ghastly, tormented Christs, all drooling with blood, hanging on crosses in very contorted positions. And I realized there are certain people who find that the sitting on the tip of a spike is the realest place in the world. Because when you're on the tip of a spike, you know you're there. There's no doubt about it. And also you know that you're expiating for everything. This, somehow by sitting on the spike, you are paying for your guilt. And so long as you hurt, you're all right. See? So these shramanas were doing something of the same kind. And the Buddha became enlightened, became a Buddha. He woke up. At the moment when he gave up that kind of quest, the moment he gave up, as we should say, trying to take the kingdom of heaven by storm. Now, what does this mean? It means that in his time, the way of liberation had become competitive, which meant it was on the wrong track. There are a lot of people who, we call it the holier-than-thou attitude, but we find it today with some objectionable Westerners who go over to Japan to study Zen Buddhism and then come home and brag about the great disciplines they've undergone and say, I sat with my legs crossed in one position for 10 hours as distinct from somebody else who only sat for 5. And always there's this tendency, you know, to have a marathon and be in a competition with others or with oneself about these things. But the moment you do that, you're back on the wheel. The best thing you can get by asceticism is to get up to the deva world. You can't get anywhere else by it. You may get down to the naraka world by asceticism too. Read the story Thais by Anatole